Well, good afternoon and blessings to each of you. It was interesting to hear Brother Miller talk about his 1W time, and of course it reminded me of 1W time many, many years ago. And can you imagine taking a group of Amish Mennonite and brethren, 18-year-olds, and putting them in Philadelphia with all of the contrast between the farm and the cows and all those things, and putting us in a place like that. Some of us did very well, and not all of us did quite as well. And so it's good to hear a testimony from a man who was there. Well, my assignment is to talk about the history of non-resistance in the U.S. before 1918. And so I spent a little time working on this. It's not uncommon for teachers to have to work on and provide materials. That's pretty common. But I felt a very, like a spiritual oppression. It felt like I have to communicate things that are difficult to communicate. And so I want to make sure that I do that and do it well. As I was working with this, it occurred to me that there are many churches in the world, but I think this can probably be boiled down to two kinds of churches in the world. So let me see if all these markers work back here. And since, you know, teachers get addicted to their whiteboards and blackboards, let's see how I do with this. So, not sure how visible that will be, but hopefully very visible. The first 300 years of the church is basically persecution. So I want to do a little background here and help us understand what I think God wants us to see here. So the first 300 years of the church are basically persecution. When you get to the year 325, we get something introduced into the church, and that's Constantine. I'll just put a C there for Constantine, and 325. And what happened here is the church is now going to have an invitation to join the society. The church has been persecuted and rejected and not accepted by society. The church is now going to have the opportunity to join the nation, so to speak. Okay? And in the process of that, what Constantine is going to do is to produce a different kind of a church. So he's going to put the church and the state together, and he's going to invite the church into that relationship, and the church is going to be very pleased and not be persecuted anymore and have the support and the defense of the military and the nations in which they are living. And so all of a sudden we have a different kind of a church. We have a church that is no longer persecuted, but a church, I'm just going to change colors here, the church after Constantine is going to be a very different kind of a church. Okay? And so when that happens, it'd be nice if we had a couple days to talk about this, but since the clock is turning, we'll have to do it quickly. And what happens with the church is that the church starts seeing, wait a minute, this is not the way we knew the church. And so what we're going to do is we're going to have to be the church, even in the face of not persecution, but now in the face of being part of the environment and part of the nation and part of the Roman Empire. Okay? And so here we're doing that. When that happens, what happens is some of the people said, no, this is not right. And since it's not right, we're going to have to separate ourselves from this church that has now become the Constantinian church. And so we have groups of people leaving the church like this. And I usually draw dotted lines because many times these people were persecuted, they were killed, the Bibles were confiscated, they were injured, they were deprived of life in many different ways. So throughout the next years, until we get to 1517, in 1517 we have Martin Luther, and Martin Luther comes online. And he begins something that we call the Protestant Reformation. And as a result of that, we have other factors that are coming into the church, into the what we call the Constantinian church, the Constantinian synthesis. The church is now synthesized with the empire, And so we have Constantine and the church together. We have the empire and the church together. And there were, we believe there were at least 70 different groups, at least 70 different groups that left that Constantinian synthesis and made their own fellowships, and they were trying to find that history is nearly impossible because it was typically destroyed. When we get to Luther and we get to the environment of the Reformation, what happens is that the Reformation opens up a whole nother door. And the Catholic Church, which has had control over the whole world for 1,200 years, is now got its hands so full they can't keep control of anything. And they have this monk in Germany who is causing them trouble. And first of all, they thought he's just a joke. And then they realized, no, this is pretty serious. Okay? And on the heels of Luther, we have Zwingli. And so we have a Lutheran church, and then we have a Zwinglian church, and then we have other divisions that are going to happen there. At the same time, we have Zwingli students, names with which you're familiar, like Conrad Grebel, is that right? Felix Mons, everybody knows this, okay? And so, out of this is going to come another movement, and that movement is going to be the Anabaptist movement, and so with Luther's revival, which is a revival of the theology, but not a revival of the life and behavior. Okay? A revival of the theology, but not a revival of the life and behavior. And so, in the heels of this, we have Menno Simons, and while, teachers want to build background forever, right? So I'll try to get to my subject here, but some of this is pretty critically important, I think. So Luther is trying to build evangelical faith, and he does a great job of it. But along comes Menno Simons, and he's a contemporary of Martin Luther, and he writes some things about true evangelical faith. Anybody know about this? Okay, there's evangelical faith, and there's true evangelical faith. And true evangelical faith cannot lie sleeping, right? It clothes the naked, and it feeds the hungry, and it clothes the fatherless, and on and on and on. He talks about this. And so what happens, because the Catholic Church has its hands so full, this movement is able to come above ground. Okay? It's able now to surface, because they just can't kill everybody. They kill a lot of people. The Martyr's Mirror would be an example. There were thousands of people who died in the Anabaptist movement. We don't really even know how many. So we have this history. And as I was studying for this, teachers are, they just never get done studying. They think they're done, and then they're not done. And then they, that was how my life's been for a couple of weeks here. And I was thinking about something. Supposing we could press this to its logical conclusion, where would it take us? Where would it take us if we could press this to its logical conclusion? If you have a Bible, you might want to turn to Revelation chapter 17. If not, you can just listen. The church in the upper line here, the dark line, is the Constantinian church. The church that is connected to the environment, so to speak. The church that's the red line is the bride of Christ. And these people will always be persecuted. What did Jesus say? If they hated me, they will hate you. Okay? And so that was the bride of Christ, and that is the way the church has lived. Now, we are so blessed to live in the United States of America, and this gets into my subject here, but before we get into that, let's talk a little bit about Revelation 17. And Revelation 17 takes that dark line to its conclusion. Okay? So if you're a person who preaches, you might want to think about preaching about this sometime. Revelation 17. I saw a woman, a harlot, sitting on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication. You see that? Constantine is emblematic of the kings of the earth. And they came to the bride of Christ and say, let me interrupt my thought here. There's a Mennonite man from Canada, no longer living, Calvin Roedekop, and he wrote a book. His book was called Free Church and Seductive Culture. Free Church and Seductive Culture. The Free Church is the church that's not connected to the empire. And they're always like an attractive young lady who's looked, and people are wondering, maybe I could get to know her. And that was Constantine. And he comes to the Bride of Christ. And he says, I'll take care of you. I'll make sure you don't have persecution. I'll care for you. Life will go well. And what did they do? They compromised. What do you think? Does this sound familiar? There's a constant wooing of the world to us. In World War II, 90% of the Brethren young men went in the military. 90% of the General Conference young men went in the military. Only 10% of the Mennonite Church young men went into the military. Do you see how subtle this has been, even in my lifetime? Okay. And so this is what is happening. And so we get this graphic language, and I felt like I was in spiritual battle reading the book of Revelation. And so here's this harlot with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication. The inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit, and so on. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, decked with gold and precious stones. On her forehead was a name written, Mystery Babylon. In verse 6, I saw the woman drunken with the blood of saints, with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. This is what happened. This church persecuted this church. Okay? This church persecuted this church. And we get to the end of the story in Revelation 17. This church is drunk with the blood of this church. Does that sound like there's spiritual warfare? Does it? I felt it. Well, we could read more of that. If I move over to Revelation 19. Revelation 19 begins the discussion of the red line, the bride line. I'm just going to read some selected verses here. In verse 7 of Revelation 19, let us be glad and rejoice, give honor to him, for the marriage of the Lamb is come. This is not the church attaching to the empire. This is the marriage of the Lamb, and his wife has made herself ready. This church has preserved itself all the way till the Lamb returns. I'll read a few more verses from chapter 21. I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a what? Anybody know? A bride adorned for a husband. The church of the dark color here is a church that's at home here. The red line is a church that's in exile. Do we believe that we're in exile? Do we? You can jot down Jeremiah 29. In Jeremiah 29, I won't turn to it and read it just in the interest of time, but in Jeremiah 29, God says to his people, I'm sending you into exile, and when you're in exile, you're supposed to work for the good of the country where I send you. That's the call on the life of the bride. Even though we don't go to war, we are supposed to work for the good of the community, like Brother Miller was telling us. Work for the good so that we bless the community, so we bless the world around us, so we bless this nation, so we bless every place we live. And we don't want to be part of the problems in the world. We don't want to find ourselves in the prison or violating the law or violating the whatever the laws are, speed limits. We should be driving the speed limit, not trying to see what we can get away with, okay? I think that's the message that Jeremiah 29 is telling us when God sends people into exile. And I think if we want to live as godly people, We need to think in terms of us being in exile. We're not home. Is that right? Okay. And then we'll think differently. Now, while I'm thinking about it, there's a word, the German word, Gelassenheit, we hear about it sometimes. Gelassenheit is the belief that you are where God wants you. And so, when God puts you somewhere, then this is where He wants you to live and do. And so, our forebears were willing to walk to their death, walk to the fire, singing, preaching, praying, testifying. That's Gelassenheit. I'm okay. This is where God called me. I'm not going to fight. If God keeps me safe, He does. If He doesn't. And then in Revelation 21 verse 9, come hither, I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife. And on chapter 22, 17, the Spirit and the bride say come, let him that hears say come, let him that thirst come, and whosoever will, let him take of the water of life freely. How amazing, as God was working in my heart on this subject, to see that if we take the subject and take it to its end, this is where we get. So there are two, I think we can say that there are two churches in the world. There's a church that has made common cause with Constantine, and later it will be Augustine, not much later, but Augustine will push something called the just war theory. Anybody ever hear of this? There are reasons why you should go to war. Okay. I guess I won't try to develop that. It would take quite a bit of time. But the just war theory was the way that the church decided that it could go to warfare. Because there are reasons why you need to. And so that came from Cicero and was developed by Augustine and so on. So we are the Anabaptist movement. We're the last group here. For the Anabaptist movement, it's the Mennonites, the Amish, Brethren, and that entire Hutterites, that whole group. And we, when we were persecuted, we many times, if you're looking for scripture, we many times quoted Psalm 24:1. Remember that one? Psalm 24:1? The earth is the Lord's. When we were told, you can't cross this line because this is Germany and this is Switzerland, you can't cross that line. We said, we don't see any lines in the dirt. And so we would go ahead and preach and pray and cross those lines. And so Revelation 17 and 19 are very important, but Psalm 24, verse 1, very, very important. The earth is the Lord's. So what should we do as believers? If you want three easy words, it would be pray, pay, and obey. Pray for the government, okay? Pray for those. The contrast here would be between Romans 12 and Romans 13. So in Romans 12, the pronoun is you. You do what's right. And you, this is the church, your relationship with each other. Romans 13 is you as you relate to the world around you, okay? God made authorities here. And part of that authority is something we have recognized in the Schleitheim Confession that was written in 1527, but has kept us with us all these years. We have followed that Schleitheim Confession, and one of the articles is about going to war or carrying a sword. And what it says is that the civil government is ordained by God. Civil government is ordained by God. And we are responsible to obey. We should never counter them. You shouldn't run away from a policeman. If you're guilty, then confess, repent, and pay. So we want to make sure that we are, and Peter says the same thing. Some people say, well, that was Paul. He was a Roman citizen. Well, but Peter says the same thing. Okay. Honor the king. So we must make sure we do that. And in the process of that, we get to sometimes in some places where we can't. And so we turn to Acts 5:29, which says we ought to obey what? God rather than man. There are times when we ask for conscientious objection. We say, I cannot conscientiously take a gun and take someone's life. And so, pray, pay, and obey. We pay our taxes. We are responsible citizens. We obey the laws. We don't go to war. We don't go to law. We don't vote in political elections. And so, many, many things here we could talk about. During the time we were in Europe, we were persecuted. Many of our people lost their lives. And so all of a sudden we have this opportunity to go to North America, and William Penn as a Quaker, and he has land here in Pennsylvania in his holy experiment. In that holy experiment, he says, I need people who will honor the treaties with the Indians. I need people who won't go to war. I need people who love the farm. And we were the classic people, and he welcomed us here. And so in the process of that, we were so happy to be here. And when we were then faced with war, for example, in the Revolution, the American Revolution, we were faced with war, and what could we do? And one of the statements we said, this was such a happy land, and now we're dealing with war in this land. What can we do? Well, several things we did, and so now I'm on my subject. In the U.S., what did we do? What was our experience? Well, one of the things we did was to reprint the Martyr's Mirror in German so we could read it. It was in Deutsch. It was in Holland Deutsch, which is a different language than Hochdeutsch, okay? And so, but our young men were getting involved in this war fever and thinking they wanted to go to war, and we were saying, what could we do? Well, maybe if we could get the Martyr's Mirror and we could get it printed in German so we could read it, maybe that would be a way of dealing with our young men. And so you're very close to the Effort of Cloister here, if you're not local, and it was the Effort of Cloister that printed the Martyr's Mirror, printed it in 1748, right here at the Effort of Press. Printed the Martyr's Mirror. And curiously, it was during the Revolutionary War, and they would have some of the leaves of the book hanging up to dry, and when the army needed gun wadding, they came and took pages of the Martyr's Mirror and used it for gun wadding. So this was a book about peace and not going to war, and the paper was actually used in some cases for war. And then after the battle, the men from the cloister would go out there and pick up the pieces and bring them back and use what they could. They also printed the, Ausbund. Anybody familiar with Ausbund? If you have Amish background, you know about the Ausbund. Well, the Ausbund contains hymns about martyrs. And so the concern was, if we lose that, then we'll forget about it that we actually were martyred. And so the Ausbund is the Amish, still used in the Amish church as a hymnal containing. So these are things we did. Many Mennonites were killed by Indians. Sometimes we were not very faithful. William Penn said, you know, the mountain range there just north of I-78, that was, you weren't supposed to go through there. That the Native American people, we call Indians, they were supposed to use that land, and we were supposed to stay south of that. But we didn't always obey. Sometimes we crossed the lines. And there were people who went over there and told the white people, hey, this is Indian territory. You can't be here. They burned down their cabins and chased them back south. Okay, there were people who were actively attempting to preserve the peace with the Native Americans here, and in the process of doing that had to get pretty dramatic. And so as Anabaptists, sometimes we got involved in some of those things. So during the Revolution, it's believed that one-third of the population here in Pennsylvania was pro-British, one-third was pro-Revolution, and one-third was neutral. And we were basically the neutral people. So we were not friends with anybody, because the pro-British people were not happy with us, and the pro-revolution people were not happy with us. So we had a struggle to be the people that we thought we needed to be. And indeed we did. And so there was a discussion about, well, who is this, who's the government? We wanted to honor the government, but who is that? When we came here, we made a promise not to revolt against King George. Some of us signed a paper, we will not revolt against King George. Because these were British colonies, and here we get off the boat speaking German, and they're worried about us because what if the Germans, there were so many Germans, and what if we all decide to revolt? Well, they told us we have to promise not to revolt against King George. And so when the colonists start revolting against King George, and we promise never to do that, what were we supposed to do? We're like torn, like how do we do this? And so the revolutionary group, they wanted us to be faithful to them, and of course King George wanted us to be faithful to him. And so how do we do that? Several things happened. One is that many of us moved to Canada. If you have a history that goes back into those times, you can find many times people moved to Canada. Why? Canada was still controlled by King George. And so you get there and you don't have this revolutionary faction. There's so many things that we could be talking about here. I'll just try and highlight some of them. So we had promised not to revolt. We did not want to revolt. And we really ran into some real snags in that the continental currency did not have much value. What did they say? Took a wagon load of currency to buy a wagon load of food. But we were people who didn't always honor the revolution, and we would take our produce to Philadelphia and sell it for hard currency. And so some of us got very wealthy doing that. At the same time, we were willing to bless the revolutionary people who were getting injured. For example, the Effort of Cloister was a place where they brought injured soldiers. And some of the people who were there actually got very sick and died because of treating injured soldiers. And so we did try to make sure that we were blessing the world in which we were living. So we finally, of course, realized that King George was going to lose the war, and so we shifted our allegiance because he was no longer the king because he was ousted. We did, I copied off something called a short and sincere declaration to our honorable assembly. This was written by Mennonites and Brethren, 1775. To our honorable assembly, notice the gracious words and the politeness of the words. And to all others in high or low station of administration, to all friends and inhabitants of country whose right they may come, be they English or German, and so on. And I'm not going to read all this, but it goes through how much we appreciated the freedoms of Pennsylvania and how we were sad to see those freedoms lost. But at the same time, we tried to recognize what was actually happening. One of the things that started happening is that we started becoming more like the colonists. One of the stories, a curious story that comes from the revolutionary period, is that there was a man named Peter Miller. After Conrad Beisel was no longer in charge of the cloister, Peter Miller was in charge of the cloister, and he was quite an educated man. And as the story goes, there was a local man who did not like him, and so there was always tension, and that man was against the government, and so he made some really unkind statements, and then the government found out about it, and he had to run, and so when he ran, he jumped out the window and tried to find some blessing with General Washington, and General Washington would not hear him. And so Peter Miller walked all the way to General Washington's headquarters, where this man was being, he was going to be hanged the next day. And Peter Miller explains to General Washington, "I came here to beg for this man's life." And General Washington said, "There's nothing I can do for your friend." And Peter Miller said, "He's not my friend, he's my worst enemy." At which apparently General Washington said, "Well, that's different," and wrote out a pardon. And Peter Miller took it to that man as he was about to be hanged for his treason. And as the story goes, they walked home together and were friends after that. That story is very curious. It's pretty difficult to document as you try to document all the history that you can. And I talked to Donald Dernbaugh, who was a man who did much of the Brethren history. I said, "Is that, what do you think? Is that a true story?" He said, "Well, it's a legendary story, but," he said, "really most of those stories had some basis in fact." So I relate it to you based on Donald Dernbaugh's recommendation. So as we go on thinking about some of the specific situations of how we related to the government and how we related as COs here, there were a family of Sowers, Christopher Sower, and there were three, father, son, and grandson. And Sower the First printed a German newspaper, and he printed a German newspaper that would circulate among the Mennonite and Brethren people, and they trusted him, and he told them who to vote for, and as long as there were people who were supported by the Germans, and the Germans were supporting the Quakers, because they knew that the Quakers would not go to war. And so Sower was the voice that spoke into the German population saying, "Let's support the Quakers, because as long as they're in power, there will not be war." And they did that, and Sower was the person who kept that happening. They voted for the Quakers. So our people did vote. But when the Quakers were out of power, and then it was other groups there under the direction of Benjamin Franklin, who did not like us at all, and under that direction, then the people who were coming into power were people who would vote for war, and then we quit voting, because we're not going to vote to support the war. So one of the curious things is that they were voting for what to spend their money for, and one of the things they spent their money for was grain. It could be grains for food or feed or other kinds of grains, and checking into that, it turned out it was grains of gunpowder. And so when those kinds of things happen, then our people said, "Well, maybe it's time for us to back away." So Sower the Second had a business, and he was captured at home by American soldiers. He was marched away to a barn. This is true. He wrote this up himself. At 56 years of age, he was marched away. He was struck with bayonets. He was stripped of his clothing, given old shirt and breeches, in his own words, barely enough to cover his modesty, marched barefoot and hatless in the hot sun. He was accused as a traitor because he would not take an oath of loyalty. His property was confiscated and sold, except for his clothing and food. And then he was a poor man from there on out. But he was willing to not fight and willing to not allow that to destroy him. So that's one specific situation. Another specific situation would be the Ephrata Cloister, and we did talk about that a little bit. There are still Ephrata martyrs' mirrors in circulation. If you have an opportunity to see them, it's worth your time. And maybe you have a family member or somebody you know has an Ephrata martyrs' mirror. There are still some of them, apparently. Sometimes some of them get sold. Another specific situation would be the Anabaptist response to all of this, which when we became, as Anabaptists, we became the breadbasket of the colony. We raised the wheat. We raised the produce. You may be familiar with John Ruth, who wrote a book called 'Twas Seeding Time, and our people said, "How can you go to war when it's time to plant crops?" And so we were trying to bless, as we saw from Jeremiah 29, we were trying to bless the community in which we lived by raising crops and providing food and providing shelter and making sure that we did well with that. Sometimes we sheltered British soldiers. We didn't see the distinction between British and the Americans. And so then we were accused of treason for doing that. So stresses and difficulties that we did occur. Another situation would be Ben Franklin. One of my instructors said that Ben Franklin was a brilliant, immoral, deist. That's a quote. So he was a brilliant but immoral deist. And so he did not like us. He called us the Dutch, and he doesn't want the Dutch. No credit to the Dutch. He tried to control the paper supply so Sauer could not get paper. He also tried to print a German paper, but people who are English and don't know German, that doesn't go so well, and it didn't go very well. And so eventually the attempt failed, and he refused to give Sauer credit, and Conrad Weiser pledged to pay if Sauer defaulted, and you can get all kinds of details about these subjects. He felt that the Mennonites and Quakers should pay a large part of the tax to support the king because we were wealthy people. We were people who had land holdings, people who were farming, and so on. Well, moving then to, I think we'll move from there to the Civil War in this country. The Civil War in this country was another time where we were struggling. And how can we be people who are consistently non-resistant in the Civil War? We had statements against slavery. Our churches were opposed to having slaves. We did not support slavery. Among some of the churches, if a slave joined your church, and some of them did, then you had to give them time to become part of the church and not own them as a slave. Also, it was a problem sometimes if one farmer was harvesting and other farmers, neighboring farmers, would come to help and bring six slaves along. What do you do then? Do you allow the slaves to work, or do you pay them? So we ran into some snags on how to deal with that. So in the American Civil War, we wrote letters to the government requesting an exemption, appealed for understanding. Sometimes we were supposed to pay fines or else hire substitutes to go to the war, somewhere between $300 apiece up to $1,000 apiece, when the yearly wage was more like $300. Sometimes the price for paying the fine, the price for paying the fine was approximately the value of 1 acre of Lancaster County farmland. So if you had one son and you had to pay the fine, which was the price of 1 acre of Lancaster County farmland, that's one thing. But what if you had five or six sons and you had to pay that number times five or six? And some of our people struggled very, very much. During this time, there was a man named John Klein who was a Brethren elder. He lived south of the Mason-Dixon line, and he paid no attention to the Mason-Dixon line. He was a physician. He would go to and treat people, treat soldiers from either side, and he would cross the line traveling to preach and so on. And the southern people thought that he was being unfaithful to the south, and so one night they ambushed him and shot him on his way back from getting his horse reshod. So there were some things of that effect that we struggled with during the Civil War. In the South, the people switched from English to German. After the Civil War, there were many people that appreciated the fact that the Anabaptists did not go to war, and then English people, were joining the German Anabaptist churches. And today, if you're familiar with the Old Order Mennonites, you know that the Old Order Mennonites in Pennsylvania would speak Pennsylvania Dutch, and the people in the South do not. Okay, and so you get to, when they get together for similar meetings, you have a little bit of difficulty with the language, but they usually work it out by using the English language. Well, World War I was the Great War, and in the last minutes here, there was a patriotic frenzy in the U.S. and very few clear policies by the government to the people, and very few policies from the church. We were not prepared. We were not prepared for World War I. And so when the young men would go, they would be drafted, they would go, they would have to put on the uniform, carry a gun, and they said, no, I can't wear the uniform, and I can't carry a gun. And so then they were punished. Many times there were very, very harsh, very, very harsh treatment of these young, especially Mennonite and brethren, young men. And so there was also a great deal of movement against the German language because the enemy was German. And so those people who spoke German were not welcome. And so it actually changed. The town of Quentin, which is close to Lebanon here, was once called Bismarck. And that street that went south into Mannheim was called Bismarck Street. But they didn't want those German connotations anywhere, and so they eliminated. It's now Quentin. It's not Bismarck. And the street is now Main Street. It's not Bismarck Street. And so many people who spoke the German were very, very afraid, because the enemy is German, and somebody's son is fighting the Germans, and there you are speaking German. And so many of the people in the Mennonite brethren communities switched from English, from German to English. One of the stories that I know, because I heard the men talk about it, was one of my distant cousins and one of his friends, and a Mennonite young man, went into World War I when they were drafted. They went to the camp, but they would not put on the uniform, and they would not carry the gun. And so what happened was these people were harassed. They were forced to dig a hole, exactly a large hole, and exactly had to be exactly measured exactly the way the officer said it did. And they had it all dug, and it was all perfect. And then they were required to put all their dirt back in there and make it look like nothing ever happened. Now, if you ever dig fence post holes, it's hard to get all the dirt back in there. And he did that, and he did it so well. And there was a danger that the officers could be poisoned. And they discovered that these 1W, or they were actually CO boys who were not 1W at that time. I made a mistake there. But they were conscientious objectors, and they realized that they could trust them. And they made them cooks of the officers, so that they could sleep well and not have to be worried that somebody's going to poison the officers. Well, as I wrap up here, just want to say that, as you heard Brother Miller talking, there were many 1W boys, CO boys, CPS boys who did very well in hospitals. And so well that where I worked in a mental hospital. Went in when I was 18, turning 19, and the local people did not like us there, because we were more conscientious, not just against going to war, but conscientious about doing our work right, which you heard him also explain, and it made the other people look bad, and so they just did not want us there. And eventually, they removed CO boys from the hospitals. And there'd be many stories about that. I would recommend a book to you. This is a book that's it's called I Could Not Fight. I Couldn't Fight. It's published now by EMP, Eastern Mennonite Publications. So I would recommend this book. There are many, many books on the subject, but I don't suppose many of you are going to read 300-page books. This one is pretty legible, readable, and available. I would recommend that to you. Well, thank you very much, and God bless you.
Thank you for listening to this message. We trust that it has been a blessing to you. If you would like additional sermons or a catalog, please visit our website at effortofministries.org. Call us toll-free at 855-557-7902 or write to us at Effort of Ministries, 400 West Main Street, Suite 1, Effort of Pennsylvania, 17522. You are welcome to copy this message for free distribution. This ministry is supported by your donations. May the Lord Jesus bless you.